Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. At least twice this year, gorillas have escaped from their enclosures in zoos. Earlier this month, a gorilla in Berlin got out and wandered calmly around the zoo until zookeepers led him by the hands back to his enclosure. Things were not so tranquil last March in Dallas when an escaped gorilla injured four people and was shot and killed after charging police officers. These incidents highlight a contradiction at the center of the zoo experience. We may enjoy seeing the animals displayed there, but we also know that they are captives, held, we assume, against their will or their nature. We might even think that we can sympathize with the gorillas in their desire to be free. Despite this ambivalence, zoos remain popular and continue to acquaint people with exotic species, animals that they would not likely encounter otherwise. The modern zoo is a relatively new institution, just a couple of centuries old. What kinds of relationships has this institution created between people and animals? What factors have shaped the encounter between people and animals that happens in a zoo? And why do we keep going back? Today on Odyssey, we're going to explore the zoo and how zoos have affected our relationship to animals. Joining us for the conversation are two historians of the zoo. From Milwaukee, Wisconsin, we are joined by Nigel Rothfels. Hello, Nigel Rothfels. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Also joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Rory Brown. Hello, Rory Brown. Welcome to Odyssey.
Hello, Gretchen, and thank you.
Thank you. Rory Brown, how long have people been capturing animals for display?
Well, it goes way, way, way back, animal keeping and collecting. I mean, if you look at a part of the world in which the Americans are much concerned at present, if you look at ancient Iraq, you look at the kings of Assyria in the 19th century, archaeologists digging out their palaces found these tremendous murals displaying the lion hunts of the Assyrian kings. And while some of those lion hunts may have been genuine hunts with the kings going out into their chariots into the marshes to track down the lions, from others of these murals it's very clear that the lions were often brought to the kings in great crates, rather like the crates in which animals are now transported. And the crate door would be pulled up and the reluctant lions would come out, and then they'd all of a sudden find the kings trundling towards them in their chariots, firing off arrows. Meanwhile, on a neighboring hillside, the inhabitants of the local city would be rushing up with their picnic baskets, ready to settle down and watch the bloody spectacle. So that sort of goes way back, this association of catching animals in order to see human performances with them. And the ancient Egyptians, it's the same thing. The female pharaoh, Hatshepsut, she sent an expedition into the land of Punt, which we think is probably now Somalia. And there are these wonderful depictions of the Egyptians arriving in Punt and raiding birds' nests and then loading out their ships and baboons climbing up the rigging and a giraffe and cheetah skins and tusks being presented to the pharaoh back home. And the giraffe was live, it's seen striding across in characteristic pacing fashion.
So millennia people have been collecting animals and enjoying them. So when, Nigel Rothfels, when does the zoo begin to take the form that we see it in today?
I think popularly we look at two really important dates. One is right in the context of the French Revolution with the establishment of a public zoo in Paris. And then probably, and Rory I think would agree on this, the opening in London of the London Zoological Gardens in the late 1820s. Those are a little bit different. These are institutions which are not, at least primarily, for the entertainment of the aristocracy or the kings or queens, but more for the edification of a rising urban bourgeoisie, and they're often, of course, in the United States too, they're built by the bourgeoisie as a place of appropriate entertainment for young adults and children. Especially as the 19th century goes on, children become a much, much bigger presence at the zoo. And so the zoo in the 19th century especially becomes the sort of place that I think we're a little bit more familiar with today.
I'd just to cut in there, sure. I'd add a bit to what Nigel says. It's true that the sort of 17th and 18th century menageries associated with royalty, these were the permanent institutions. But already in the late 17th, 18th, early 19th centuries in Europe, and then throughout the 19th century in America, how a lot of people would have seen animals would have been in traveling menageries, which would often have had a base in a city, but would have been trundled around. And these menageries could have quite a lot of animals in, and quite big animals, rhinoceroses, elephants, obviously the lions, tigers, ostriches, cassowaries, so that some of these menageries could be quite substantial, but they were essentially commercial enterprises, and they were usually sort of, if they were housed in buildings, they were stuffy buildings, and they were also, of course, as I say, commercial. They gave shows, and they sold their animals. They traded in their animals for people to have in their parks and gardens.
Did that continue after the establishment of public zoos?
Oh, yes.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. Yeah. There's throughout the 19th century, throughout the 20th century, there are all sorts of commercial ventures of moving animals around, either in sort of permanent menageries stationary menageries as described by Rory, but also the traveling menageries. You know, in a way that sort of evolves, that's part of the evolution, in fact, of the traveling circus, you know, which always had a menagerie with it in the late 19th century and 20th century. So people, you know, We have a friend in Atlanta whose background is in the Circus Historical Society, and Richard Reynolds will point out that the way he was exposed to animals as a child were in these traveling menageries, which were really quite extraordinarily extensive with some of the major circuses.
So did zoos?
But even pet shops, you know, when I was a child, you could go to my local pet shop. I could go and I could buy a Himalayan sun bear or a chimpanzee or a fruit bat.
And with Rory,
or a bush
he may
baby.
In fact have done that.
Well, I'm wondering whether the zoos, the public zoos, felt a need to distinguish themselves and what they did from those commercial entertainment-oriented traveling menageries. Rory Brown.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the two zoos that Nigel mentioned, the Jardin des Plantes in Paris, the zoo that was founded during the French Revolution, which was associated with the Parisian Museum of Natural History and was presided over by professors, and the London Zoo, which was founded by the Zoological Society of London, ostensibly with a scientific purpose to exhibit new and curious species and creatures of the animal kingdom. These zoos were about exhibiting the new animals that the European scientists were discovering and classifying, that they were like, as it were, in a sense, living museums, though they always, as Nigel said, had a very important and often subversive public exhibition and entertainment function.
So people went to zoos for the same reasons they went to the traveling menageries. Some of the same
reasons.
Oh,
yes, yeah. Yeah, you went to poke the lion and to give a peanut to the monkey.
And feed the elephant, of course.
Yes,
well, give
the elephant a tip. You know, there were always these great stunts that elephants. You would give the elephant a coin, and the elephant would give the coin to the keeper. The keeper probably kept the coin, and then in return, the keeper would give the elephant a piece of stale bread or something.
Well, that's
great fun.
Well, that's quite a bit different from the experience one would have at a zoo today, in the sense that you don't really play with the animals when you go to the zoo. Maybe there's a few that you can pet, but in general, you get to observe, but there's not a whole lot of interaction. So were these zoos, these 19th century zoos, significantly different than zoos today? Nigel Rothfels?
Well, it's interesting. I think the do not feed the animals signs begin to really proliferate in the first half of the 20th century, and that is about animal health. The reality, of course, is that animals continue to be fed, and even continue to be fed by the public, but in much more controlled settings. So now it tends to be feeding is done a little bit maybe after hours by members of the Zoological Society and important donors who would like to have a little bit a closer experience with the animals. This I think often happens. In fact, it happened to me only 2 days ago when I was at our local zoo, and I was there with my son, and I ran into one of the keepers I know, and there was just a little opportunity to have a little interaction with an animal, and so that happens, and I think that that's a very important part, in fact, of what zoos can do in terms of, you know, giving people the opportunity to have a little bit closer experience with animals.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We're talking today on the program about zoos and how zoos have shaped our relationships with animals. Rory Brown, what else is different, or what other differences are there between a zoo of today and a zoo of the 19th century?
Well, I'd like to take up Nigel's point and your point about this whole question of feeding. As Nigel says, there's a real shift, I think, in the late 19th, early 20th century between the old, what were often termed the menagerie zoos of the 19th, mm-hmm. and the sort of newer zoos of the 20th, in terms of distancing the people from the animals. The animals are presented as a spectacle, as on a stage, but in the course of this sort of presentation of the animals in exotic settings, or in the course of just trying to preserve the animals' health, they're distanced from the public. You know, apes are put behind glass so that people can no longer cough on them or spit on them. This was a thing that people used to enjoy in menageries, spitting on the monkeys and getting them to spit back. Glass is put there. Nigel is obviously the expert on Hagenbeck and the invention of the moated zoo. But although in a sense that brings the person into the animal's area by removing the ostensible barrier, the bars, it also pushes people further away from the animals. And so zoos become more, as it were, of a spectacle, of a scene. In a sense, the public is taken off and out of the stage and separated from the animals, so that there is the need now in modern zoos, I think, to bring the public back in and re-involve them with the animal. And it doesn't always work to have these hyper-naturalistic exhibits in which the animals are difficult to see. People go to the zoo and emerge somewhat unsatisfied by that. So instead, you have these organized feedings. And Nigel talked about, you know, here we have in Boston, we have a giraffe that is ill, and we're trying to sort of nurse it to help, and we've launched a public appeal, and part of that public appeal is people can come behind and feed the giraffe. But then there are also other specifically designed exhibits in zoos where people can actually feed the animals. Like the lorikeets, these brightly colored Australian, I think, parrot-like mm-hmm. birds, which flock down to people who come in, their nectar feeders in the wild, and people have these great jars of honey and syrup and things, and they walk into the aviary, and the lorikeets sort of cluster down, so all you can see is this sort of brightly covered assemblage of plumes, red and yellow and green, and in fact actually under there is a person holding one of the jars of syrup. And so people are brought back for this contact with animals, which I think in a sense the modern exhibit has separated them from, consciously and unconsciously too.
So over time we have, for a variety of reasons, we have greater separation between people and animals, and yet the allure, to some extent, the allure of the zoo remains the possibility of interaction with the animals.
That's
yes,
absolutely
I think
correct.
So.
I mean, you know, hearing Rory's description of the lorikeets brings back something called the parrot walk in the 19th century, which was very popular in zoos, where people, they would, on a pretty day, they would essentially put all their parrot collection, and in most zoos, especially in the London Zoo, actually, in the 19th century, the parrot collection could have something like 80 species. I mean, it was not sort of a trivial collection mm-hmm. because of the sort of desirability of the scene, really, and people could walk down a little promenade where all the birds would be out and tethered on stands, and they can feed them. There's some beautiful artwork and some, you know, just sort of, I think Max Liebermann actually did a beautiful painting of the parrot walk in Amsterdam in the late 19th century.
All right, we need to stop for a moment and take a break. We're going to come back and continue talking about the tradition and actually go back and talk some more about moats and zoos and the way zoos are laid out today and where that comes from as we examine a little bit more what sorts of interactions people have with animals in the zoo. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We'll be right back. listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Our conversation today is about zoos and the way that zoos have shaped or mediated human relationships with animals. Our guests today are Rory Brown, who is a historian. He's also Associate Dean of Freshmen at Harvard University. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Zoo Times, A Social History of Zoos. We're also talking with Nigel Rothfels, who is a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Nigel Rothfels is the author of Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. Nigel Rothfels, one pole of the ambivalence about zoos has to do with the fact that we know these animals are captives, you know, that they've been taken from their natural habitat and placed in this zoo, placed on display for our pleasure. Now, one of the things that you were talking about before has to do with the way that they are increasingly displayed as being remote and distant from human beings, kind of mimicking that the wildness or the remoteness, the exoticness of the animal itself. Does that change come about because of people's anxieties around captivity?
It's a wonderful question. I think that what we need to look at is the very end of the 19th century and right at the beginning of the 20th century, and this fellow that I've written at length about, a man named Karl Hagenbeck, who was a German entrepreneur. He was an animal dealer in the most sort of, you can totally imagine this. This is basically a guy who would buy any kind of exotic animal that arrived in the port city of Hamburg and then sell it to people all over the world. And then he began sort of sending his own expeditions out to catch animals in the late 1880s, and, especially. And so by the end of the 19th century, he is known around the world among people who are interested in collecting and displaying animals as the person to go to if you want a certain kind of animal. No matter what it is, he'll essentially get it for you. And what he does right at the beginning of the 20th century is build a zoo. It opened in 1907 in Hamburg. It's called Hagenbeck's Tierpark or Hagenbeck's Animal Park. And the zoo was notable at the time for attempting to show animals in naturalistic exhibits. And he invented this idea of the moat that we all know in zoos. And then he arranged his exhibits in these panoramas where you could stand from one position and look out essentially at an African scene or something that would include, you know, little animals up close, and then maybe a little pond with some animals fooling around in the pond, and behind that some zebras and different kinds of antelope, and then behind that some lions, and behind that some wild goats and vultures up on a hill. And it looked as if that was a seamless scene with all the animals living together, and it was an extraordinarily successful form of exhibit, which of course was immediately picked up in zoos all over the world, and he designed his company designed zoos in the United States. And if you go to, in Chicago, say, Brookfield, you are looking at the legacy of Hagenbeck, what we tend to call the Hagenbeck Revolution, where animals were taken out of cages and put in these naturalistic exhibits.
And what was the motivation to be nicer to the animals, to give them a better living situation in their captivity?
No. That's a very simple answer. The motivation was that this was what people wanted to see. They were becoming increasingly discomforted in front of bars. They didn't like the idea of the animals sort of pacing back and forth. And this looked like the animals were in the wild, and they looked free. I mean, people talked about their liberation from the cages. This was seen as a kind of release for the animals. But the exhibits were not really designed, I think, to be clear, the animals were not at the forefront of Karl Hagenbeck's vision, and really no one else's. The idea was to create a sort of popular form of exhibit for people, not a sort of ideal form of exhibit for animals.
So people felt that these things looked more natural and were better for the animals, but no one consulted the animals or really thought through like what might be the best situation for the animals.
Well, I mean, you know, in fact, in terms of safety, for example, it's quite possible to imagine exhibits for animals which have bars on them and could have, you know, reasonable amounts of space and everything else that could, in fact, be better for animals, for certain animals, than these sort of open exhibits where they're exposed to sort of the sort of constrained behaviors of other animals in an exhibit, especially in mixed species exhibits. So this is a form of exhibit which has everything to do with our desire, and that is the visiting public's desire to feel happy in front of animals that appear to be living in the wild, and not really with the, at least in its original form, not really with the what would make an animal happy.
But Rory Brown, you were talking before about interaction with animals and a sort of intimacy with animals, and you were saying that these kinds of exhibits actually put greater distance. But what do you make of that desire for intimacy with these animals in particular? I mean, people have pets, people have livestock, they have relations of closeness with animals of all sorts, but there's something about these particular animals in the zoo?
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of these animals you can relate to and personalize. I mean, lions with their broad, flat faces, lions and the enormous cultural baggage behind them. You know, when you see a lion in a zoo, you're not seeing a lion in a zoo. You're seeing a lion in a zoo through your own cultural spectacles. And what Nigel is talking about at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries is obviously a precise historical moment. I mean, it's the height of imperialism. It's the opening up to Europeans of East Africa. It's the description of East Africa and the vast plains of game as being this sort of Eden. And I think that that is surely a sort of cultural referent and influence upon the design of these enclosures. Just as here in America, about the same time the Bronx Zoo is being founded, and there, while they keep the exotic animals, i.e. the non-American animals, in traditional style animal cages, and you can still see adapted to other purposes the old lion house and the monkey house, which has now been turned into a house for small South American monkeys, but previously had everything from the great apes on downwards, and even the elephant house, which is there, a great sort of domed Italianate building looking rather like the State House here in Boston, which used to have elephants in individual stalls, now has very few elephants in and have these enormous naturally designed outside paddocks. Well, the Bronx Zoo, as I say, was founded about the same time, just about 10 years before Hagenbeck's, and was consisted of these formal gardens and these formal animal houses. But beyond, behind that, they had what they described as open and naturalistic ranges for their North American animals. And that was in part to impress upon the public, particularly the immigrant public of New York, the great nobility of the American game animals and of the frontier and the great open spaces. So although it was a sort of improvement in some respects for the animals being kept in more naturalistic groupings, larger groupings in larger cages, it actually, in the short run, proved very difficult because they were eating unsuitable grasses. You know, bison from the plains were eating grasses of New York State, which gave them terrible indigestion and things. So it did at least tell the public and educate them about the animals, the disappearing great game animals of the North American continent, but it also was part to do with the sort of social conditioning, introducing people to the idea of the American West, this land of plenty to which they'd come from the heaving masses from Europe.
And so, are you also saying, and setting up different ideas and different relationships with different kinds of animals, like one set of ideas for the North American animals, another set of ideas for African or South American animals?
Yes. I think that there was a heavy emphasis, a sort of almost nationalistic emphasis, on the North American animals. You know, bears, which in Europe had been intended to be kept sort of indistinctly of species in pits, were now to be exhibited in open-air dens with natural rockwork. And because, of course, it was very important to show that North America was greatly superior to the rest of the world in the number of bear species. This is being in the 19th century when people tended to separate every race into a separate species. North America was quite clearly far ahead and far superior, both in the terms of the sort of real estate they could give their animals. We would have a zoo park here and not a zoo gardens, but also in terms of the sort of nobility of the animals here.
Rory Brown is the author of the forthcoming book, Zoo Times, A Social History of Zoos. We are talking today on the program about zoos and how they have shaped our relationship to animals. Let me give our number. We will be taking calls in just a few minutes. Our number is 888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. If you would like to join in our conversation, we invite you to give us a call. It is toll-free anywhere in the U.S. We're also talking with Nigel Rothfels, who is the author of Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. Nigel Rothfels, I want to poke a little bit more at this idea of differing relationships with animals or maybe hierarchies of animals, because zoos, it seems, have always been about exotic animals, not about the animals you would find. I mean, you wouldn't go to the zoo to see squirrels. You'd go to see something exotic and interesting. But what else can you tell us about the way zoos may have contributed to setting up different relationships with different kinds of animals?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I would say that there probably are some squirrel connoisseurs out there who would take issue with the idea that we don't go to zoos to visit squirrels, but...
Absolutely.
I don't want the squirrel lobby after me, so
okay,
I'll take it
good.
Back.
No, I think, I mean, the long tradition, of course, has been to display animals that are particularly rare, particularly beautiful, particularly large. You know, we call them the sort of exotic megafauna, or, yeah, they're particularly fierce. And that, you know, that has, I think that that has been something which has driven, in fact, a great deal of what, you know, of zoo programming over the last couple hundred years. I mean, there's an interesting problem today. For example, about elephants in zoos, I think there's a great many people who believe that it would be a little unusual to go to a zoo that doesn't have an elephant in it. Meanwhile, there are people who are very, very concerned about the status of elephants in zoos, who feel like, well, the zoo is actually the place that elephants might not actually belong. And so that kind of stress on the sort of institution is a really interesting thing for us right now, because clearly there are a great many animals that people sort of expect to find in zoo. When I say people, you know, the public might expect to find in a zoo, that you know, over the long term, looking say 50 years from now, we may not be seen in zoos. And you know, another example, for example, is the, you know, the issue of dolphins. You know, that people, you know, kind of adore dolphins in many, many ways, and yet there are people that sort of feel that maybe dolphins are the sort of animal that might not be ideal for zoos. And you know, in Chicago, you have the Shedd Aquarium, and it has the Pacific white-sided dolphins and also orca whales, and you know, that the whole sort of dynamic of whether certain species, species really that people are very, very fond of seeing, should be in zoos as we go into the future is a very, very serious question.
But
I'd like to actually say a word, though, if
sure.
I may, for the squirrel lobby, because I think the squirrel question exhibits the complexity of the zoo as an institution, who it's for and who it's run by. If you go to the 19th century, zoo directors, London, Paris, Berlin, etc., said, yes, we've got to have the squirrels. We've got to have
obsessed
every sort of animal.
we've
got to have every species of animal. That's our job, is to exhibit species. So if there are infinite varieties of squirrel, we've got to have infinite varieties of squirrels in our zoo. Now, in the 20th century, the late 20th century, the early 21st century, we've sort of turned the squirrel thing on its head, because this time, or the squirrel's chasing its tail, whichever metaphor you like, because now people are saying, a lot of zoo people would say, yes, the squirrel may not be popular as a zoo or exhibit animal, but our zoo should have this squirrel because it's actually very rare in the wild. People may not appreciate the, the Malabar squirrel, for instance, or the Prevost squirrel, but we need to have them in this zoo because we need to establish a breeding colony. So I think often the zoologists or the zoo professionals running the zoo may have different preferences from the people who visiting the zoo, and also from, as it were, the showmen, the commercial people running the zoo. And then the other thing to say is that while it's true that familiar animals, we often think of zoos as places where we go to see exotic animals, remember, exotic animals can be domestic animals. So in the 19th century, they would have this, for instance, Cuban hounds in the London Zoo, which were very interesting because they were huge dogs used to chase down runaway slaves in Cuba, but they were exotic to the average Londoner. Similarly, at the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of zoos acquired domestic cattle, because as Mayor Curley of Boston said, Boston children are so divorced from the countryside, they now think that milk comes from bottles. So cows became exotic animals for the urban public visiting the zoo.
Let me jump in here and give our number one more time. It's 888-859-1800. 1-888-859-1800. It's toll-free anywhere in the U.S. So give us a call if you'd like to join in our conversation. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Nigel Rothfels, let's talk a bit more about the cross purposes that we might have going on in terms of visitors to zoos and people who run zoos. If people don't come to see infinite varieties of squirrels, and perhaps they do, I'm just saying, maybe they don't. But, you know,
most people don't, yeah.
Maybe they come to see the elephants or the gorillas or, you know, the big exotic animals. Okay. So why do the zoos want to have infinite variety? Like, why isn't there a closer match?
Oh, I don't think most zoo directors at this point would actually consider infinite variety a goal anymore. This was about sort of a taxonomic impulse of the 19th century, wanting to have, you know, every imaginable beetle and every imaginable, I hate to say it, squirrel. But I think now it's about having a collection which is both has an educational purpose for the public, and that's sort of broadly defined as giving it young people, especially, I think, an opportunity to see sort of the typical animals that you know they've been asked to sort of know something about, while also you know clearly sort of trying to meet the conservation goals of the sort of the Association of Zoos, the American Zoo Association. Which have to do with bringing certain kinds of species into zoos where there is clearly not a huge public for it, but the zoos themselves have, or the directors of zoos and the curatorial staffs of zoos have decided that these particular animals could in fact benefit meaningfully from being, you know, sort of carefully bred in captivity. I know in the Milwaukee County Zoo, for example, we have several Micronesian kingfishers. Now, this is a bird that that most people won't even notice when they walk by it. However, beautiful it may be, it's this beautiful sort of orange and blue bird. We have one male on exhibit and a couple that are trying to breed as well. And this is a bird which is extinct in the wild, and it's and part of its recovery is clearly going to happen in the context of zoological gardens working together. So, you know, there's clearly different sorts of purposes. There's a scientific purpose, which continues to happen at zoos. There's an educational purpose for the public. There's an entertainment purpose. And there's also clearly a conservation purpose that happens in zoos.
Which may go together and may conflict.
I think they can. I think there are moments, you know, a classic one might be the panda. There are those who would argue that exhibiting pandas in captivity may not, in fact, be to the long-term benefit of pandas in the wild, mm-hmm. Because they become commodified in certain kinds of ways, which might be sort of not the ultimate goal. On the other hand, it can also be pointed out that panda breeding has been sort of increasingly successful in zoos.
Okay, let me stop you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with some phone calls. Our number is 888-859-1800. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. We've been talking today on the program about zoos, looking at how zoos have changed over time, but how zoos mediate our relationship to animals or shape the way we think about animals. Our guests today are Rory Brown, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Zoo Times, A Social History of Zoos, and Nigel Rothfels, who is the author of Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. Our number one more time, 888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Ken. Hello, Ken. You're on Odyssey.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to bring up the point that a lot of zoo design has evolved since the 1960s with the input of field research. People like Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey have really explored how these animals live in the wild, what their social systems are like, and what their physical environments are like. And that's been taken by the zoo people and somewhat replicated, but also groups of animals are kept together in more natural groupings now.
Nigel Rothfels, comments?
Yeah, that's a really very important point. I think in the grouping, especially with certain social animals, obviously like chimpanzees and Jane Goodall's importance in, you know, she's has a commitment to making sure that the conditions of chimpanzees in zoos improve. And I was in a zoo, I think it was Taronga Park in Sydney, Australia, where there's a fabulous exhibit that looks like a termite mound. And the chimpanzees there will use the mound to extract the termites or bits of food out of it. It's about sort of coming up with enrichment ideas for animals that would make sense based on field research. I think it's a very, very good point. I think, in fact, that that serves a really important educational mission of the zoos who can, especially those zoos which can afford to do it. Unfortunately, there's some cost realities about what can really be done and numbers of animals. There's a bonobo exhibit here in Milwaukee, which I think, in fact, the entire group of these sort of chimpanzees, I think might even be in excess of 15 animals. And this is, this would essentially have been unheard of in the 19th century. But this is about, in fact, constituting, a community for the animals, which is a meaningful community for them and is not really in any way about exhibiting the animals for the public.
Yeah, and I think that... the gentleman caller is absolutely right about the direct influence of field research on the very best of the modern exhibits. I mean, I know that Terry Maple, the then director of Zoo Atlanta, who's himself an expert on gorillas, and John Coe, the zoo designer, I think they actually went off to Africa and studied the plants among which the gorillas lived and which they ate before they designed the Ford rainforest exhibit, the mm-hmm. gorilla exhibit at Zoo Atlanta. So I think this has been very important. And as I say, and Nigel's and the caller's mention of Jane Goodall is very important, because I think that what Goodall has done is not only influence. I mean, if you look at zoo professionals now, many, many zoo professionals are themselves trained not just in applied zookeeping but have university degrees. Keepers are different now. A lot of keepers now are young women who are much more trained than the old sort of laborer types of the past, and have a much more greater concern about applying the latest field research to the animals. And of course the public is more educated. I mean, Hagenbeck's public could go to the zoo and think they were sort of seeing a simulacrum of Africa. If we now go to Hamburg, or if we go to actually many of the barless moated zoo exhibits built in the sort of 60s, 70s, and even 80s, they look to us very sort of concrete-ish now. Mm-hmm. But I think the modern exhibits built from the 80s onwards, incorporating so much of the research, and as a sense demanded by the public, grown up on documentaries, National Geographic documentaries of Goodall and her work, and Diane Fossey and the Hollywood movies about her, the public demands more, the keepers demand more, and the zoo administration demands more.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Lynn. Hello, Lynn. You're on Odyssey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to know the panel's opinions about the new ape exhibit at the Lincoln Park Zoo here in Chicago, where the animals are actually able to control their environment to a degree by turning fans on and off, and they can also blow air at spectators watching them behave in their enclosures.
Is this in the Regenstein building, or which is this?
I'm not sure.
I read an article about it in the Trib this weekend about this new interactive primate exhibit.
Oh, it sounds wonderful.
When I went to Chicago, was shown around by Mark Rosenthal, then curator of large mammals. The building was still in foundation stages, so I haven't seen it. But I think that these interactive exhibits, and it also calls to mind what they've done at the National Zoo with their think tank, where the orangs can sort of brachiate across a sort of swing along a sort of climbing frame through the zoo to come down into this laboratory-like building and then sort of work on computer on science. I mean, a lot of these exhibits, of course, what the animals are doing is not what they do in the wild, but it's something that tests their skills, enhances our respect for the animals by seeing how well they can learn and how much they can do that we think that we alone can do. And also, of course, it keeps the animals active. And as I say, it may not be exactly what they do in the wild, but it gives them a chance to occupy themselves and to prove their skills.
Okay, but doesn't it also just give us the satisfaction of seeing animals do things, which is part of why
yes.
we go?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I think the animals in motion is a really important part, and animals interacting with the public is a very, very important part of our experience. And one of the things that, you know, I haven't seen the exhibit as well, but one of the things that strikes me about it from your description is that, again, precisely because the animal is not sort of pretending, is being forced to pretend it's living in Africa, but is sort of the exhibit is in a sense highlighting the enrichment opportunities of an animal in a zoo. It strikes me as a very sort of smart and creative way of dealing with captivity.
I think that is often the criticism that people make, and they make even of the new exhibits, that, you know, I mean, a lot of the time in the wild, animals spend sleeping, lions, etc. People, of course, are used to documentaries in which the documentaries are highly edited, so you only see the animals when they're doing something. So we all become rather sort of impatient. We want to see the animals doing something. And that doing something goes back to what we were saying earlier about interaction. You know, people like going to SeaWorld, not only to see Shamu, the killer whale, perform, but also for Shamu to then plunge back into the water and splash everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, people like animals to interact with them, providing it's on the people's terms, you know you're going to get splashed rather than on the animals. That parrot walk that Nigel
talked
about at
the beginning. In other words, you're going to get splashed by the whale, but not eaten.
Yeah.
And it gets back to the point of the escaped gorilla as well.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, like the parrot walk in the 19th century, people preferred to see the parrots out on their perches. If you went into the parrot house, people always ran out because the parrots made such a dreadful racket. When you have 80 different species of parrots concentrated in a small house, it's a din that's worse than the radio going wrong.
Not to mention the smell.
Less with parrots, but more with apes and lions, etc.
We're talking.
I miss smell in zoos, though. I must say, I think many of these modern zoos, I think if we want to truly see the world as the animals see it, we should smell.
We're talking today on the program about zoos and the way that zoos have shaped our relationships with animals. And we've been talking about the kinds of interactions people have with animals in the zoo. You are listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Let's take another call. Let's talk with Steve. Hello, Steve. You're on Odyssey.
Hi, Gretchen. I love your show. Another good show today. Thanks.
Thank you.
I was wondering if the speakers could talk a little bit more about the history of our ethical awareness of animals and when we started thinking about them as ethical beings who have concerns. I mean, they sort of briefly mentioned dolphins and other and primates and some other things that we are now sort of understanding are intelligent and maybe not so happy about being caged up. I'm wondering when we started thinking about that.
All right, Rory Brown?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of this dates back to actually to the period about which Nigel and I were speaking earlier, the period of the Bronx Zoo and of Hagenbeck's. You get in England, for instance, Henry Salt, who was a pioneer vegetarian, attacking the London Zoo over the feeding of live animals to its reptiles. You get Edmund Sellers, who was a bird watcher, who, unique for the time. Instead of shooting birds and stuffing them and identifying the dead birds from their plumage, he'd actually go out into the field and come back with information about courtship and about territory, that birds had a sort of inner life, if you like. And he attacks the London Zoo, and he attacks specifically this idea of the postage stamp zoo, where that you have one of every type of squirrel or beetle or bat. And in fact, he argued if the zoo was to fulfill its educational function and show animals behaving naturally, and if indeed if it was to be humane and the animals were to be happy, you should keep them in larger enclosures in natural groupings, and you should have fewer species. So I think there's a definite, in the late Victorian, early 20th century period, there's a definite break, and these new zoos that we were talking about sort of coincide with that, this demand to see the animals absent the bars, which, as we know, is a slightly sort of, you know, sleight of hand, but still it goes with this move to present animals in more and treat them more humanely, and actually to give this. Henry Salt is also the author of the book Animal Rights, that Peter Singer and the animal rights movement of today has re-edited and treats as their Bible.
Nigel Rogers?
Yeah, I'll just add one quick mm-hmm. comment, and that is I think there's often a sense that people have that the animal that they're standing in front of must somehow be nostalgic in some way about a different kind of existence. And I think it's actually very important to remember that it's actually impossible for most of the, especially the larger animals in our zoos, to be nostalgic about any other form of life than what they have in front of them. I mean, this is, they were not, by and large, they were not caught in the wild, and they were not sort of schlepped off to foreign shores for exhibition. And so that's always strikes me as a really kind of an interesting problem, that in fact this is the life that a particular animal is living in the zoo is its life, and it's not necessarily, it's always sort of struck me, it's not necessarily sometimes it may look to us like a type of a sad existence, maybe, or a melancholic existence, and it's actually, especially when you see the animals interact with their keepers over time, and you think about the sort of expectations that they might reasonably have about a day, it wouldn't necessarily be a life, even though to us it might seem sort of dull in some contexts, it wouldn't necessarily be that way. I think some of the exhibits, for example, that people really criticize as being very sort of barren, they may not be as barren as we think they are, especially if one thinks about sort of the interaction of that animal with other animals and the interaction with their environment and the interaction, most importantly, with the keepers, who are, you know, for many of the sort of more social animals, the keepers are a very, very important part of their social life.
You know, the real news, if I may say so quickly, is not that three gorillas have escaped within the past 18 months or so. The real news is why more zoo animals don't escape. And as Heini Hediger, who is the sort of philosopher of the modern zoo, pointed out, what we have to do in the zoo is to convert the cage into the animal's territory. And when the gorilla that escaped from Franklin Park Zoo in Boston escaped for the first time, when he got out for the first time, he then clambered back into the cage and went back into his holding pen at the back, but when he saw the other gorillas being moved back into their holding pen, he wanted to get back in the cage. He wanted to be with the others. He'd gone out to look around, but he saw the cage in a certain sense and the other gorillas as his society and his home and his territory. And that is, I think, as I say, the real news is why more animals don't escape, not why animals do escape.
Nigel Rothfels, we've just got about a minute left, but let me ask you perhaps an unanswerable question. But at bottom, why do people like watching animals do things so much?
I wish I could answer it. I wish I could answer it for myself. There's something I think where when we're standing in front of an animal, there's a sense of otherness, but also a connection where it seems so completely different from us, and yet also not. And the sense of connection to the animal, as well as its difference, I think, is what makes it for us such an important sort of thing to experience in the world. And you know, maybe even the more strange or the more distant from us can be as appealing as the more like us.
Nigel Rothfels is a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He is the author of Savages and Beasts, The Birth of the Modern Zoo. Rory Brown is a historian and associate dean of freshmen at Harvard University. His forthcoming book is called Zoo Times, A Social History of Zoos. Rory Brown and Nigel Rothfels, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks very much. It was great fun.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Neil Verma, our intern, Joe Perna, and our production assistant, Ragnar Anderson. Our technical producer is Steve Waranowskis. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy and Delia Lloyd. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Special thanks today to Ernst Carroll for engineering our program. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager and head zookeeper Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Today's Odyssey is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, promoting excellence in the humanities, and by the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.